Chapter 20. Next morning, his nose still in the dream bag of a deep pillow, contributed to his otherwise austere bed by sweet Blanche, with whom, by the parlor game rules of sleep, he had been holding hands in a heartbreaking nightmare, or perhaps it was just her cheap perfume. The boy was at once aware of the happiness knocking to be let in. He deliberately endeavored to prolong the glow of its incognito by dwelling on the last vestiges of jasmine and tears in a silly dream, but the tiger of happiness fairly leaped into being. That exhilaration of a newly acquired franchise, a shade of it he seemed to have kept in his sleep, in that last part of his recent dream in which he had told Blanche that he had learned to levitate, and that his ability to tread air with magic ease would allow him to break all records for the long jump by strolling, as it were, a few inches above the ground for a stretch of, say, 30 or 40 feet. Too great a length might be suspicious, while the stands went wild, and Zembovsky of Zambia stared, arms akimbo, in consternation and disbelief. Tenderness rounds out true triumph. Gentleness lubricates genuine liberation. Emotions that are not diagnostic of glory or passion in dreams. One half of the fantastic joy Van was to taste from now on, forever, he hoped, owed its force to the certainty that he could lavish on Ada, openly and at leisure, all the puerile petting that social shame, male selfishness, and moral apprehension had prevented him from envisaging before. On weekends, all three meals of the day were heralded by three gongs, small, medium, and big. The first now announced breakfast in the dining room. Its vibration suscitated the thought that in 26 steps, Van would join his young accomplice, whose delicate musk he still preserved in the hollow of his hand, and affected Van with a kind of radiant amazement. Had it really happened? Are we really free? Certain caged birds, say Chinese amateurs, shaking with fat man mirth, knock themselves out against the bars and lie unconscious for a few minutes, every blessed morning, right upon awakening, in an automatic, dream-continuing, dream-lined dash. Although they are, those iridescent prisoners, quite perky and docile and talkative the rest of the time. Van thrust his bare toes into a sneaker, retrieving the while its mate from under the bed. He hurried down past a pleased-looking Prince Zemsky and a grim Vincent Veen, Bishop of Balticamore and Como. But she was not down yet. In the bright dining room, full of yellow flowers and drooping clusters of sunshine, Uncle Dan was feeding. He wore suitable clothes for a suitably hot day in the country, namely a candy-striped suit over a mauve flannel shirt and piqué waistcoat with a blue and red club tie and a safety gold-pinned, very high, soft collar. All his trim stripes and colors were a little displaced, though, in the process of comic strip printing, because it was Sunday. He had just finished his first buttered toast with a dab of ye olde orange marmalade and was making turkey sounds as he rinsed his dentures orally with a mouthful of coffee prior to swallowing it and the flavorous flotsam. Being, as I had reason to believe, plucky, I could make myself suffer a direct view of the man's pink face with its rotating red tashy, but I was not obliged, mused Van in 1922. When he saw those Baganodier flowers again, to stand his chinless profile with its curly red sideburn. So Van considered, not without appetite, the blue jugs of hot chocolate and baton segments of bread prepared for the hungry children. Marina had her breakfast in bed. The butler and Price ate in a recess of the pantry, a pleasing thought somehow, and Mademoiselle La Riviere did not touch any food till noon. Being a doom-fearing midinette, the sect, not the shop, and had actually made her father confessor join her group. "You could have taken us to see the fire, Uncle dear," remarked Van, pouring himself a cup of chocolate. "Ada will tell you all about it," replied Uncle Dan, lovingly buttering and marmalading another toast. "She greatly enjoyed the excursion." Oh, she went with you, did she? Yes, in the black charabanc with all the butlers. Jolly good fun, rally. Pseudo-British pronunciation. But that must have been one of the scullery maids, not Ada, remarked Vaughn. I didn't realize, he added. We had several here. I mean, butlers. Oh, I imagine so, said Uncle Dan vaguely. He repeated the internal rinsing process and, with a slight cough, put on his spectacles. But no morning paper had come, and he took them off again. Suddenly, Vaughn heard her lovely dark voice on the staircase saying in an upward direction, Je l'ai vu dans une des corbeilles de la bibliothèque, presumably in reference to some geranium or violet or slipper orchid. There was a banister pause, as photographers say, and after the maid's distant glad cry had come from the library, Ada's voice added, Je me demande, I wonder qui l'a mis là, who put it there. Aussitôt après, she entered the dining room. She wore, though not in collusion with him, black shorts, a white jersey, and sneakers. Her hair was drawn back from her big round brow and thickly pigtailed. The rose of a rash under her lower lip glistened with glycerin through the patchily dabbed-on powder. She was too pale to be really pretty. She carried a book of verse. My eldest is rather plain but has nice hair, and my youngest is pretty but foxy red, Marina used to say. Ungrateful age, ungrateful light, ungrateful artist, but not ungrateful lover. A veritable wave of adoration buoyed him up from the pit of the stomach to heaven. The thrill of seeing her and knowing she knew and knowing nobody else knew what they had so freely and dirtily and delightfully indulged in less than 6 hours ago turned out to be too much for our green lover, despite his trying to trivialize it with the moral corrective of an opprobrious adverb. Fluffing badly a half-hearted hello, not a habitual morning greeting, which, besides, she ignored, he bent over his breakfast while watching with a secret polyphemic organ her every movement. She slapped lightly Mr. Veen's bald head with her book in passing behind him and noisily moved the chair next to him on the other side from Vaughn. Blinking, doll-lashing daintily, she poured herself a big cup of chocolate. Though it had been thoroughly sweetened, the child placed a lump of sugar on her spoon and eased it into the cup, relishing the way the hot brown liquid suffused and dissolved one crystal-grained crumbling corner and then the entire piece. Meanwhile, Uncle Dan, in delayed action, chased an imaginary insect off his pate, looked up, looked around, and at last acknowledged the newcomer. Oh yes, Ada, he said. Vaughn here is anxious to know something. What were you doing, my dear, while he and I were taking care of the fire? Its reflection invaded Ada. Vaughn had never seen a girl as translucently white-skinned as she, or indeed anybody else, porcelain or peach, blush so substantially and habitually, and the habit distressed him as being much more improper than any act that might cause it. She stole a foolish glance at the somber boy, and began saying something about having been fast ablaze in her bedroom. You were not, interrupted Vaughn harshly. You were here with me, looking at the blaze from the library window. Uncle Dan is all wet. Ménagez vos Americanismes, said the latter, and then opened his arms wide in paternal welcome as guileless Lucette trotted into the room with a child's pink, stiff-bagged butterfly net in her little fist like an oriflamme. Vaughn shook his head disapprovingly at Ada. She showed him the sharp petal of her tongue, and with a shock of self-indignation, her lover felt himself flushing in his turn. So much for the franchise. He wringed the napkin and retired to the Mestechko, little place off the front hall. After she too had finished breakfasting, he waylaid her, gorged with sweet butter, on the landing. They had one moment to plan things. It was all, historically speaking, at the dawn of the novel, which was still in the hands of parsonage ladies and French academicians, so such moments were precious. She stood scratching one raised knee. They agreed to go for a walk before lunch and find a secluded place. She had to finish a translation for Mademoiselle La Riviere. She showed him her draft. François Coppé, yes? Their fall is gentle. The wood chopper can tell before they reach the mud, the oak tree by its leaf of copper, the maple by its leaf of blood. Le chute est lente, said Vaughan. On peut les suivre du regard en reconnaissant. That periphrastic touch of chopper and mud is, of course, pure Loudon, minor poet and translator, 1815 to 1895. Betraying the first half of the stanza to save the second is rather like that Russian nobleman who chucked his coachman to the wolves and then fell out of his sleigh. I think you are very cruel and stupid, said Ada. This is not meant to be a work of art or a brilliant parody. It is the ransom exacted by a demented governess from a poor, overworked schoolgirl. Wait for me in the Bogenaudier Bower, she added. I'll be down in exactly 63 minutes. Her hands were cold. Her neck was hot. The postman's boy had rung the doorbell. Boot, a young footman, the butler's bastard, crossed the resonant flags of the hall. On Sunday mornings, the mail came late because of the voluminous Sunday supplements of the papers from Balticamore and Kaluga and Luga, which Robin Sherwood, the old postman in his bright green uniform, distributed on horseback throughout the somnolent countryside. As Vaughan, humming his school song, the only tune he could ever carry, skipped down the terrace steps, he saw Robin on his old bay holding the livelier black stallion of his Sunday helper, a handsome English lad whom, it was rumored behind the rose hedges, the old man loved more vigorously than his office required. Vaughan reached the third lawn and the bower and carefully inspected the stage prepared for the scene. Like a provincial come an hour too early to the opera, after jogging all day along harvest roads with poppies and bluets catching and twinkle-twining in the wheels of his buggy, Floberg's Ursula. Blue butterflies nearly the size of small whites and likewise of European origin were flitting swiftly around the shrubs and settling on the drooping clusters of yellow flowers. In less complex circumstances, 40 years hence, our lovers were to see again, with wonder and joy, the same insect and the same bladder senna along a forest trail near Susten in the Valais. At the present moment, he was looking forward to collecting what he would recollect later and watching the big, bold blues as he sprawled on the turf, burning with the evoked vision of Ada's pale limbs in the variegated light of the bower, and then coldly telling himself that fact could never quite match fancy. When he returned from a swim in the broad and deep brook beyond the Bousquet, with wet hair and tingling skin, Vaughan got the rare treat of finding his foreglimpse of live ivory accurately reproduced, except that she had loosened her hair and changed into the kirtle frock of sun-bright cotton that he was so fond of and had so ardently yearned to soil in the so recent past. He had resolved to deal first of all with her legs, which he felt he had not fettered enough the previous night, to sheathe them in kisses from the A of arched instep to the V of velvet, and this Vaughan accomplished as soon as Ada and he got sufficiently deep in the larch wood which closed the park on the steep side of the rocky rise between Ardis and Lador. Neither could establish in retrospect, nor indeed persisted in trying to do so, how, when, and where he actually deflowered her. A vulgarism Ada in Wonderland had happened to find glossed in Frode's encyclopedia as to break a virgin's vaginal membrane by manly or mechanical means. With the example, the sweetness of his soul was deflowered, Jeremy Taylor. Was it that night on the lap robe, or that day in the larch wood, or later in the shooting gallery, or in the attic, or on the roof, or on a secluded balcony, or in the bathroom, or, not very comfortably, on the magic carpet. We do not know, and do not care. You kissed and nibbled and poked and prodded and worried me there so much and so often that my virginity was lost in the shuffle. But I do recall definitely that by midsummer, the machine which our forefathers called sex was working as smoothly as later, in 1888, etc., darling. Marginal note in red ink.